Science Faction is a science education podcast for adults only. It is not intended for children or monocle-wearing British nobility.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 274. Science Faction, the origin of our solar system.
It's becoming more relevant to our lives. We're getting closer to home.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the origin of the galaxy, which we did. We actually started with the origin of Science Faction, which is pretty relevant. Then we did the origin of the universe, which to some people, arguably, is even more important than the origin of the Science Faction podcast.
In the same way that a presidential election is more important than, like, a city council election.
Right.
But you know, politics is local, you know, like that local election has way more relevance to your life than that presidential election.
Then we did the origin of stars. That's fairly relevant for most people.
I'm sorry, I don't believe in constellations.
That's true.
I've
read your blog about the
stars don't exist. I wish they did.
Damien conspiracy theory number 84.
What happened to all the stars?
Indeed. And now we are doing the origin of our solar system. So our solar system, it should be noted, is not quite unique, but rare among solar systems within our galaxy in that we are not a binary system. Most systems actually tend to be binary systems in our galaxy, meaning that they have two stars and they rotate around a kind of a central gravitational area. We obviously only have one. I just like to think we're not greedy. You know who's super greedy? Luke Skywalker with his two-star system.
Are we the Lance Armstrong of solar systems as well? Could you also argue?
Right. Yeah. We only have one nut, but we're winning.
Was there a cancer that happened in our solar system years ago.
That's exactly correct. All right, so we'll go through a few-step process that is, again, very broad. We're not 100% sure on all of this, but this is kind of the leading theory as to how our solar system developed. So the first part, a cloud of interstellar gas or dust is disturbed and it collapses under its own gravity. And that could be caused by anything from a nearby supernova to any big force coming through this
Death
nebula.
Star in your galaxy.
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes they create planets. Well, stars, I guess. Then as the cloud collapses, it heats up and compresses in the center. And it heats up enough for the dust to vaporize. The initial collapse is supposed to take less than 100,000 years. So basically you see this giant cloud of dust slowly collapsing in on a single point. And we kind of explained how this happened before. We talked about star formation with gravity as gravity kind of pulls that in.
So it's like a T-1000.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Together like a T-1000.
And just like we talked about star formation before, the center collapses enough to become a protostar and the rest of the gas orbits and flows around it. So most of that gas flows inward and adds to the mass of the forming star because gravity's pulling it in. But the gas is rotating, and the centrifugal force from that prevents some of the gas from reaching the forming star. So as it's spinning, you think of what happens when you spin something over your head. The effect is a force pushing towards the outside. At least that's how we feel it, is a force pushing towards the outside. Or think of going around a curve in a car. You're pushed up against the door, right? So that force is keeping some of the materials outward. It keeps it from going in the way gravity wants it to. And that forms what we call an accretion disk. So a big flat disk of that debris kind of spread out in the same plane.
Good point. But it's actually pronounced centrifugionized.
And as the disk radiates and cools off, that stuff starts to solidify. So right there, we kind of have like a little stop. And depending on the details, the gas, the orbiting star, or the protostar may be unstable and it starts to compress under its own gravity. If that happens, it produces a double star. If it doesn't, then we get a single star like in our particular solar system.
Do you feel that our solar system feels less than when it meets its other solar system?
When it meets the binary one? Yeah, it's like being the only single birth person in a room full of twins. You're the outcast now.
And your solar system's infested with humans.
We're used to hearing that the sun is a pretty typical star in terms of stars in the galaxy.
Right.
It's sort of halfway through in mass between the whole spread.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, as much as 75% of the stars in the galaxy are red dwarfs, which are like one-tenth the
right.
size of the sun.
And a totally different type of star, by the way, like in terms of the fuel and what's in the interior and everything else.
Yeah. The mass of a sun completely determines its temperature and properties mm-hmm. and how long it lives. And red dwarfs, because they're so much smaller, they're fully convective and you don't get this buildup of concentric layers of fuel running out that you do that leads to supernovae. Mm. And so they last for like 10 trillion years.
There's
there's not a single red dwarf in the universe that has burned out yet.
Wow.
We got screwed with our sun. We're a bunch of suckers.
It's also harder to have life around them, though, because they're a lot more volatile and have more flares. So we got kind of lucky.
By the way, the term red dwarf is not politically correct. We prefer to say Native American little person. So if you could just use that from now on.
By the way, that is the best pronunciation of the word dwarf I've ever heard come from you. Usually you just say dwarf.
That's true. And basically, as this accretion disk cools off, it will begin to form the planets that we currently have as everything kind of coalesces together, as opposed to the star itself, which is also forming in the center. And remember, as we talked about before, we can't have a scenario in the initial universe where this happens and we get a solar system like ours. Why not? Because the stuff that we are made of, the carbon that we are made of, a lot of the heavier elements that we have around us forms from the explosions of stars. So you need to have this first generation of stars that were burning brightly and doing their whole thing and then going supernova and exploding the contents of themselves out into the universe for us to have carbon, for us to have heavy metals, for us to have most of the stuff other than hydrogen and helium. We need to have had a generation of stars be born and die so we could be created out of their bones.
And this wasn't necessarily required for life because you can get the carbon and oxygen and phosphorus atoms from just supernovae. But a lot of the rare earth elements and heavy metals came from not just exploding stars, but neutron stars colliding into one another.
Neutron stars being giant, very, very energy-filled structures, right?
Yeah, it's the last thing you can get before a black hole. It's the absolute densest possible object before gravity just crushes everything.
I don't want to have a conversation about political correctness again, but if you can stop using black hole, we have a different word for that as well.
What is it?
No, you know what, David? You'll just keep going on.
African-American orifice.
Yeah, okay.
Fistula.
And basically, as stuff cools off, we start getting the formation of all the planets surrounding us. We have things like asteroid belts that form even further out. We have the Kepler belt even further out. We have, at this point, a lot of stuff coming into the solar system. So at the early solar system, it wasn't like it is now, where we are in a fairly calm area. Occasionally, you get comets and asteroids come through. But most of the way has been cleared. These planets have been going around for so long. They've cleared their orbit of all the debris. And then all the stuff on the outside is getting caught in asteroid belts. All that kind of stuff is a more modern thing. Before then, it was wild. Any planets that formed during that early solar system were being constantly bombarded, not only by comets, but by other large impacts. In fact, 4.5 billion years ago, we think the reason we have a moon is that the Earth collided with another planet. We have now named it Theia or Theia. And we think that this collision, just monumental collision, imagine two planets colliding together, actually not only formed the Earth, but the debris that was then shot out of this giant collision ended up coalescing into the moon itself.
When this planet didn't signal lanes and just ran into us.
Right.
Did they just hit and run? Like what?
No, they became part of us. Like it literally melded into the Earth being constructed of the proto-Earth and Theia hitting together. And then the debris of that coalesced, like kind of came out into a cloud and coalesced into the moon. And think about what this means for us. One is, thank God it happened, you know, 4.5 billion years ago and not even a billion years ago we had life going for a long time at that point. So one is that's great timing for us. But two, think of what the result of the moon is. Look at the moon. What do you see? Craters everywhere. Our planet used to look like that too before we had an atmosphere. But also the moon does act like a protector. The moon rotates around us and collects or redistributes a lot of the asteroids away from us. So without that collision with Theia at that point in time, and then the resulting moon that came about, you know, who knows what life on Earth would look like without that. We kind of had like the bully protector. The moon has been sitting up there pushing away those bully asteroids and comets for a long time.
Well, the moon, like the Earth, applies makeup to cover up its pot marks,
yes,
and like in true. The form of life and winds and everything. Like the moon is just au naturel. It wears its acne scars with pride.
Super long armpit hair. Yeah, and then we kind of get to a proto version of our current solar system where we have a nice big burning sun. We have these planets rotating around it. We still get asteroids and comets come through, but it's pretty calm. We've gotten into our middle age years. We're no longer out partying like crazy. We have much calmer lifespans.
So yeah, orbital dynamics are just incredibly chaotic. Even though we currently live in an age of the solar system where things have kind of settled down and the planets have assumed orbital resonances with one another, mm-hmm. and so they don't really deviate much in their orbits. In the early solar system, while things were still forming, we think like Jupiter was just running all around, going in and out up to like 5 times closer to the sun than it currently is, and that probably caused a lot of this bombardment that affected Earth and could have brought Theia over.
Because think about what's going on when you have these giant objects rotating around each other. At first, when it first kicks off, now their individual gravities are still fighting with each other, pulling into each other. They're going to offset their different orbits. It isn't until you get kind of in your groove and you've been there and doing that for a long time that everything stabilizes out. But before then, it's wild. You have things moving well beyond their normal orbits. You have things getting sucked into other things. The collision with Theia was undoubtedly not the only planetary collision. There was probably some on some of the outer planets as well. You just have a lot of chaos before stuff settles in.
Even with as few as three bodies, the three-body problem, where if you just have three objects interacting gravitationally, there are initial conditions to that problem where you can't have a closed-form solution. The best you can do is mathematical approximations.
Right.
And so, obviously, the solar system is a lot more complicated than three bodies. And so even though things are kind of settled now, Lyapunov time of the current solar system, which is how long you can predict into the future before things just get too chaotic, is only around the scale of 100 million years or so. And so we can't even predict that far into the future what the planets are going to look like.
Right.
And so the early system was so much more complex. That's why we still don't know a lot of things about our solar system and if there's even a Planet Nine out there orbiting really eccentrically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, think about what it means, too, when you talk about that gravitational attraction. A lot of people think we are being pulled around by the gravity of the sun that is emanating from the center of the sun. But that's not true. Anytime two bodies
The sun is orbiting the Earth.
That's correct, Damien. No, well, actually, in a way, it kind of is, because anytime two bodies are interacting with each other gravitationally, it's not the center of the large body that somehow pulls everything in. It's actually kind of what you would call a midpoint, though not actually midpoint between those two. It depends on the gravitational mass of each. But it's a point someplace off that center that's offset based on the size of the other object. So, for instance, if you had two objects that were the exact same size, like a binary system with two that were the exact same size, it wouldn't be like one was spinning around the other. They would both be spinning around a central point between the two that was essentially equidistant. However, since we're not the same size as the sun, not even close, it's not like it's equidistant between us and the sun that we're spinning around. We're spinning around a point that's slightly outside that gravitational center of that sun. And the same thing is true of all those other planets. So in a way, the sun kind of wobbles and rotates with very, very slightly within the solar system, causing a bunch of other wobbles and rotations throughout all of those orbits.
Sun's our bitch.
And that's where those really subtle second-order effects, they're hard to notice, and Newtonian physics is normally great for calculating trajectories.
Right.
But one of the first predictions of Einstein's general relativity was some anomalous movement in Mercury's orbit.
Right.
And it's just something that is very subtle because of these, you know, differences in gravity and spinning and stuff. And
that was later proven. That was one of the first proofs of relativity, was the fact that we did see this slight wobble in that orbit. Yeah, so very, very interesting stuff. We're going to stop the story there because we don't want to jump on the lead of the origin of Earth later on. So we will leave that at the origin of the solar system. But very interesting, and it is important to remember that while we can say this story, we can start this story from the beginning of, okay, there was this interstellar cloud. The reality is you do have to go back into some of our other origin stories to see how that cloud got the materials that are in it for us to be here watching this solar system. You had to have those stars explode beforehand.
Just so you know, if you ever ask Bobby like what the origin of Batman is, he will actually start at the origin of the universe.
Yes, and then get to move the Wayne forward. Family. Technically, you have to start that with every story. What is the origin of it?
Bobby's a literalist.
Yeah, I go right back to the Big Bang. And speaking of the Big Bang, I, of course, am your host, comedian and archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. And thank you for missing the opportunity to call me the Robin to your Batman.
No, you're more like the moon to my sun. So keep those asteroids away.
Listen, I know you ain't trying to throw asteroids at Earth. I know you ain't.
And our scientist for the evening, Dr. Troy. Dr. Troy, how you doing?
I'm doing good. It's nice to be back.
It is great to have you back. Those of you guys might remember, Dr. Troy was here when we had an unfortunate audio incident, so we had to cut his iCall BS. But his iCall BS was the best iCall BS we've ever had, because he had actually read multiple articles that we cover, and he got a perfect score. Like everybody we've had here, completely beat Damien. Still yet to have a single win.
Not true.
Damien still has yet to have a single win.
2 weeks ago I won.
But
beat Bill.
But Dr. Troy can come back and do it all again. Now, Dr. Troy, for those of the people who might have missed it because we had such bad audio, you want to give a quick recap of your background?
So I just got my PhD in bioengineering, and I helped develop these robotic systems that are evolution machines, basically, and they control microbial growth environments and track their growth rate. And so you can use that to evolve them to different conditions or evolve genetically engineered strains and do metabolic engineering.
And there was a documentary about your work entitled Evolution. I believe if you guys haven't seen that bad sci-fi movie.
David Duchovny.
Remember that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
Selenium, I think, was the poison.
Very interesting stuff. And you can go ahead and check out Dr. Troy's bio as well as some of the other science guest hosts on our website, www.thesciencefaction.com. And if you want to hear a good ungoogleable question, you can tweet us at Faction Science. And we're proud to announce that we are finally broadcasting from our new Science Faction studios. So we're not doing this in my living room or the Madhouse Comedy Club anymore, Damien.
Great. And when our neighbors don't provide noise interruptions, this is an awesome studio.
Yeah. All right. Let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, and actually the main article for the entire show. This is a series of articles that just got released, all based off the same DNA evidence that has been put together by an international team. This is an amazing amount of work, just amazing. They basically sequenced the DNA from all of the oldest human remains we have in North, Central, and South America, got all this data together, and did a monumental amount of work that has really clarified the entire occupation of the Americas to a degree we haven't had in a long, long time.
Some of our fans may not know about your long-running grudge against Brazil, its language of Portuguese, and the science that comes out of that country.
I love Brazil. I have no problem with the science. Portuguese is a gross language. But regardless.
But the science as well.
Sometimes
criticized.
Sometimes the archaeology out of there cannot be as scrupulous as it should be.
I'm just saying, you said this was a multinational study.
Yes, Brazil was involved.
Did you purposely exclude those articles?
No, not at all. And some of the remains from Brazil were some of the most important parts of this study, actually. But they looked at remains all the way from Alaska down to Patagonia. They looked at stuff that was as old as 11,000 years old, all the way up to 600 years old. They looked at a bunch of different groups, and they basically really flushed out a lot of the genetic shifts throughout the continent of the past 20,000 years. Really, really amazing for somebody like me who loves the idea of the occupation of the Americas, who thinks that's the great unanswered question in archaeology and human paleontology. This is really amazing. It's really impressive. It confirms some stuff we already knew. It showed us some very new, incredibly interesting stuff we would have never considered before. And this is my favorite part, I've been asked by a bunch of people, hey, Bobby, you do this science show, a weekly science show for the past 6 years, looking at every major science article published. What's the most interesting story you've ever done? This hits on
dolphin sex has to be
no,
dolphin
it's
sex.
Not dolphin sex. This hits on the most interesting story I believe we have ever done, the most underreported science mystery that we have ever covered, and this touches on it and amplifies it and makes it even more interesting. So we'll get to that at the very end. This is an amazing set of articles.
Death
that
of
came
the Saiga?
No, not even the double dick nose saga. No, this is an amazing article that came out. It links together a whole bunch of different studies. So let's jump into it. So again, we looked at a whole bunch of different ancient human remains from all across the Americas. And we found that indeed our main hypothesis for the occupation of the Americas is indeed correct. All known native groups come from basically the Beringial group, which is a group of northeastern Asians that got genetically isolated 20 some odd thousand years ago in what is now a submerged continent called Beringia. They lived there for a while, becoming completely genetically isolated before moving down in to the Americas and becoming all of the natives of North and South America. That has not changed. That was actually confirmed by this data.
How much would sea level have to decrease in order to reveal Beringia again?
That's a good question. I think parts of it are like 50 to 100 feet down, but the sea level at the time was 360 to 410 feet down. So Beringia was up and out of the water at that point. And keep in mind, sometimes people talk about a land bridge. Beringia is this land bridge in between Asia and North America. But bridge is the wrong term, because when you say bridge, you're thinking, okay, what is this, like
suspension,
right? Maybe a mile or two wide. This is a 1,000-mile wide, quote-unquote, bridge. So this is a large piece of land. We may think of it as a bridge because we're thinking of it as the perspective of Asia to North America, but in fact, they just thought of it as the continent in which they lived in. It's 1,000 miles wide.
So if we could just sink the sea level... if we could solve climate change...
Right, and then reverse it and get real cold...
Get an ice age going... Tons of new real estate.
Absolutely.
An entirely new continent.
Absolutely.
Lex Luthor this.
So what particular remains did they look at? They looked at a tooth from Alaska. They looked at the Spirit Cave mummy, which is the oldest naturally forming mummy on Earth. They looked at a bunch of different human remains from South America, including Peru and Brazil, and other places like Mesoamerica. Like I said, some things were already confirmed. The Beringian occupation, the uniformity of that genetics. We did not find really any substantial influx of other people, though we will touch on that in a second. The quick occupation of the continents. People got into North America and were almost immediately in South America. They made it down very, very quickly.
Do you think that the North American natives, like, you're going the wrong way to the ones going south?
Right.
It's going to suck down there. It's hot. It's hot. The rainforest is a terrible environment to live in.
I don't know. There's a lot of food down there. It seems like everything can kill you. It seems like it'd be nice down there. Oh, and of course, as we've talked about before, we have talked about the different skull morphologies of a lot of early populations of the Americas, how it looks more like different groups, like Polynesians or something else. It was indeed confirmed that those different skull morphologies did not represent different groups of people. They are most genetically related to Native Americans. So basically what happened was we had genetic drift, and the phenotype means that the skulls look differently, but it's still the same genetic population. So all of those basically confirmed what we knew. Very, very interesting stuff. However, there was a lot of stuff that was completely unexpected that was found. So first one was that the Beringian population hung out in Alaska for a long time. That 9,000-year-old Alaskan tooth, it was of those ancient Beringians. It's a population that's now completely extinct, but it was the ancestral population to all of the native groups. All of the North American and South American native groups came from these people. One group of them split off and came down into North America. It then split a second time, where one group kind of occupied the east coast of the United States, and another group started heading down and occupying the rest of both North America and then South America. But the ancestral Beringian group, which we weren't sure when they went extinct, their remains are still in these 9,000-year-old teeth. So they lasted until at least 9,000 years ago in that Alaska region, long after the waters had come up. And surprisingly, for instance, in this particular tooth that we looked at, we call it a milk tooth or a baby tooth of a young girl who was living in a place, she was living in a place that was completely surrounded by water. Evidence of ancient Beringian people show that those people had a lot of maritime resources. They almost all ate maritime resources. This person who lived on a peninsula surrounded by water on three sides, who's the descendant of these ancient Beringians, didn't have any maritime food resources. They actually
find that she had no diesel in her teeth.
Yeah, right. No, you can look at their teeth and you can actually see the buildup of certain things, and you can see that she was eating terrestrial food. That's really interesting. It means that the ancient Beringians hung out in the same area but changed their life ways over that time before finally going extinct.
They forgot the ways of the ancestors, the ways of their Beringial
fishing,
forefathers, and whale hunting.
One of the other really interesting things involves the Clovis people. So we've talked about Clovis before. It's a group that's around 13,000 years old to around 12,000 years old. They made a very distinct type of tool technology. If you were around 30 or 40 years ago in archaeology, you might have thought they were the earliest people of North America. We now know there are many, many sites much older than the Clovis technology. But we do have a Clovis skeleton from Montana. We checked the DNA, and what we found was really surprising. What we found was that it looks like these people are the ones that broke off and occupied Central and South America to start off with. That's really surprising, because we had not thought Clovis technology or Clovis people made it down that far, because we've never found any Clovis artifacts that far south. However, the DNA seems to show that there was a group of people who continued moving south, and they just changed their tool technology. So the initial settlement of Central and South America was done by Clovis people, by the Clovis culture that we have here in North America.
What advantages would a Clovis tool have over my Phillips head screwdriver?
None. The screwdriver is made of steel and would be much better at driving. Well, actually, no, I take that back. It would be better at taking down a mastodon. But Clovis is just a specific type of tool-making technology. It has to do with fluted points, just lithic stuff that's not really interesting to most people. But what is interesting is this group of people that we have widespread throughout the continent of North America. We thought they were just in North America. It turns out they went down and they occupied Central and South America. However, they are not where the majority of South American DNA comes from.
So if I'm a Clovis and I'm going into a territory occupied perhaps by another person, do you think I'd like show up with my tools and the other guy go, is that a Clovis?
Yeah,
check out the fluting here.
Yep,
that's exactly correct. And then I outfish him or out-hunt him.
Then what happened is about 8,000 years ago, there was a group from Central America, from Mesoamerica, that ended up expanding. They went down into South America and they went up into North America. In North America, they come up into the Great Plains area, part of the Central Basin, that kind of area. In South America, they conquer everything. So this group comes out of Mesoamerica and almost completely replaces all of that ancient Clovis DNA. They eradicate it. Now, almost all of the DNA that is found in native groups in South America comes from this expansion of Mesoamerica 8,000 years ago. We had no idea this happened. That's really, really interesting.
Get out of here with your fluted tools.
No, again, remember, the Clovis people didn't bring their fluted tools with them, otherwise we would have found it. That's the distinction. It's get out of here with your genetics that made the fluted tools a long time ago.
We don't want you here.
Another very interesting find was that while that is the majority of South American DNA, there is a part of South America that takes its DNA from someplace very surprising, which is about 5,000 years ago. There was a migration from Southern California, specifically the most genetically related people we could find are the ancient skeletons from the Channel Islands here in Southern California, that made their way somehow all the way down to Peru and became the genetic precursors of modern-day Peruvians. So the Inca culture shares its DNA with the Channel Islands of California more so than any other group on Earth.
Which is why there's such a predominance of surfers in Peru to this day.
That's right. If you see those old Inca statues, a lot of them are on surfboards. Very, very interesting. No, who would have called that? That this weird genetic isolated group of Southern California would end up being the ones that give rise to ancient Peruvians. That's such an interesting story. And those are genetically distinct from the mass amount of South America that seems to take its DNA from Central Americans.
They wanted to go someplace where it can get that high altitude training. They had a fight coming up.
Right. Well, what's funny you mentioned that is one of the studies that was kind of accompanying all this stuff was the genetic study of how Peruvians have their genetic distinctiveness of being able to survive in highland areas. We know that there are two major groups of people who do this who have genetic advantages to surviving in really, really high altitude areas. One are the Tibetans and then one are the Peruvians, and they do it in different ways. It's really interesting. It's like almost like convergent evolution. The Tibetans get some of their high altitude DNA from Denisovans, and they do it based on their ability of their heme or their blood, part of their blood to capture oxygen. They have a genetic mutation that allows them to do that better. The Peruvians, they also are able to live super high up. They have a completely different genetic adaptation that actually affects the size and strength of their heart.
Yeah, my research is a lot of looking at adaptive mutations. And a striking thing about evolution is how there are just so many different ways to arrive at the same phenotype.
Right.
So you select for one trait and you'll get these two different, in my case, bacterial strains, but obviously it happens with humans as well, different methods to achieve that objective function for the cell. And I think there's like a Filipino diving tribe that
yes.
They also have a need for greater oxygen when they go free diving. Their evolution to that was to get like 50% larger spleens
right.
So they can store more
blood. We covered
blood.
That a while back.
Yeah. Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And that was another one that you wouldn't expect. How would the spleen let you hold your breath longer, right? And that's a completely different style of oxygen adaptation. That wouldn't necessarily help you breathing in thin air, because the whole idea of the spleen is you're almost storing that air secondarily in your body as opposed to being able to take more air out of the environment. So that's a whole different adaptation to low oxygen levels of a different type.
It'll be really interesting to see, because I think this current study was done sequencing a bunch of like a million SNPs.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like they sequenced the entire genome of
right.
all these different
people. I think they did
people.
Do the entire genome of a few of them, but you're right. Most of them were SNPs.
Once we get to the point where whole genome sequencing for this number of people is feasible from a practicality and cost standpoint, we'll be able to see a lot of features that you wouldn't be able to see beforehand. And just the fact that they were inhabiting a new land,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be a lot of adaptive mutations there. And
yeah.
So that'll probably point to interesting regions of our genome that we don't even know about yet. Because a lot of times we find out a gene trait association because there are populations we can
right.
sequence that have some difference that sets them apart.
Yeah, and so this is just basic convergent evolution. You know, anybody who's taken a decent amount of biology or evolution in school would recognize this. Some of the striking examples are if you look at Australia, where you have marsupials, a very ancient form of mammal, right? And they're related to other mammals very, very, very basally. So some of the furthest reaches of mammals. And they evolved separately in Australia after it became genetically isolated. And you have things like the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, the Tasmanian wolf, that grew up and evolved almost an identical body shape to a wolf, but they're not at all closely related. They're about as far away as you could be related as different mammals. You know, they're much more closely related to a kangaroo or an opossum, and yet their body type, if you saw one of these things from far away, you would say, oh, that's just a regular dog, canid, that's a regular wolf. It is complete convergent evolution. They are not at all closely related, but because they filled the same niche, evolution guided them to almost the exact same body structure.
If left to their own devices, perhaps in a zoo or a circus, would those two mate? If one of
There's
them
no way they could mate. They're so different.
If one of them were to Bugs Bunny themselves
yeah.
in drag.
It would be more like Pepe Le Pew and the cat, where you actually would have, like, you can mate all you want, but you're not producing offspring.
That's fine. I mean, it'd be like a human in any sci-fi movie where he banged anything other right. than a human.
Those aren't called sci-fi, Damien. That's a different type of movie that you're not really supposed to be bringing around the office.
Find the next generation fan fiction, and I will have Worf.
And it leads us to the most exciting part of this whole thing, something that's super interesting. I have been shouting this particular study from the rooftops. People have asked me for a long time, Bobby, you run this weekly show, you look at all of the major science news that comes out. What is the most interesting thing that you guys have ever covered? There is a story that came out in 2015 that to me is so underreported. I talk to people every single day in archaeology, informal academic archaeology. Nobody knows about this study. It is so crazy that it's not talked about more. But a long time ago, we covered this in 2015, a genetic study revealed the hint that there was Australasian DNA among very specific tribes in South America. Not all the tribes and not anywhere else except for one area in South America. Australasian DNA. Now, Australasians are Aboriginal Australians, New Guinea Highlanders, Solomon Islanders, very, very ancient group of people. The first successful exodus that we know of out of Africa, some of the most divergent humans on Earth. Those people, so that DNA was found, these little things, and not a modern inclusion, a 10,000-year-old inclusion. How could that be possible? Because even if you were to theorize, okay, well, maybe these Australasians somehow made it to the Americas a long time ago and nobody ever knew about them. Okay, well, then they should have interbred with all the natives coming in later on, and we should have their DNA sequences all through North, Central, and South America. If you were to say, okay, well, maybe they came in later. Long after the natives that we currently know came in, they came in and they mated with those South Americans. Well, then you have to explain how they were able to make it all the way down through North America, Central America, into South America without mating with anybody else. It's a mystery that nobody talks about and nobody knows the answer to, and it's in a very localized group of native individuals from South America.
Maybe their tradition is you can only mate with somebody who knows what a boomerang is and knows what a didgeridoo is, and they had to find a tribe willing to learn their ways.
Okay.
In order to mate, and it was a survival thing.
Maybe it was that none of the other tribes knew what a knife was and had to constantly keep explaining it to them.
I have a question about your convergent evolution in humans.
Uh-huh.
All right, so if you're the Peruvian with the genetic adaptation to high altitudes.
Right, the bigger heart.
Oh, and the Nepalese person, the Sherpa.
Uh-huh, with the blood, different heme.
Is there a downside to either one of those to living your life at sea level?
No, I think it would be an advantage.
So there's no disadvantage to at all?
I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe there could be, but
I'm trying to create a eugenic Superman, yeah, and I'm looking at traits that I need to take to right. create this creature.
I would say this, though. Both of those people tend to be very short in stature. Like, those are the Highlanders in both Peru and in the Tibetan Highlands are incredibly short people. I think they have an average height of like 5'3". So,
yeah, but we're going to mix those features, and then we're going to give them the huge spleen of the small Filipino divers.
All right.
And we're going to put that in like J.J. Watt's body.
Okay. I like all this. And then mix a little LeBron in there.
There are often trade-offs in traits, so you generally can't get great specialization at a lot of different features without having sacrifices in other areas. So even though we may not know them, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some issues for them living at sea level.
I got a problem. They mixed too many bad genes together. Now I got this huge dick. It's can't ride a bicycle.
Ladies always contacting me.
And yeah, things can be good in some environments and bad in others. I think there's some Neanderthal DNA. I forget in what people it's in, but it provides a benefit in one environment, but it also makes them more prone to get diabetes.
Yes, and allergies, actually. A lot of the allergies we currently have are from Neanderthal genetics and, you know, might have been useful if you were living as a hunter-gatherer and not as useful if you're living as a modern human.
Well, in building my Superman army, my genetic Superman army, I'm willing to sacrifice things like human empathy,
mm-hmm.
shortness, compassion, critical thinking skills. I don't want that.
Yeah. Why would you want those guys? But this new study reaffirmed that Australasian DNA connection, and we still have no idea how they got there. There's a whole bunch of different ideas and theories. My best one is this. Here is my postulation of how this could have happened that the genetic evidence would explain. And by the way, just finding this is huge. Just knowing it's there and reconfirming those old results is giant because it completely changes the occupation story of the Americas. But here is my idea. I think because this is an ancient infusion 10,000 years ago, I think it's unlikely that you had a group of Australians sailing across the Pacific Ocean. That seems nigh impossible. open ocean water techniques like that didn't come anywhere close to that until the Polynesians 8,000-9,000 years later. And that group, the Australasians, have never shown that type of propensity to be able to cross an ocean. It's incredibly unlikely. The currents go the wrong way. It would just be a very, very hard thing to imagine that 10,000 years ago, a group of Aboriginals jumped in a boat and sailed to South America.
I've heard that the Aborigines, even the ancient ones, made strides in walkabout technology. Is
yes,
that possible?
Yes, but the problem was they never really deployed floatabout technology. And that's the issue. So my best idea is that these people entered the Americas the same way the Beringians did. They made their way up through East Asia, and most of their descendants died out, up through the Beringial area, then down the coastline. So the question becomes, when did it happen? Were they there before Native Americans, or what we call Native Americans now, or did they come afterwards? My best guess is they were actually here before. And the reason is simple. I don't think that they would have been able to come up later on without leaving genetic traces. I think that we would have traces of them all the way through northern East Asia, all the way through all these other places. However, we do know that that same population, the Australasians, basically occupied all of South Asia for a long time before being completely eradicated by different groups like the Han later on. So it's not unreasonable to think they also occupied Eastern Asia, maybe in that exodus 70,000 years ago when they occupied New Guinea and Australia and everything. They made their way around, small groups, small, very localized groups, made their way into the Americas the same way the Beringians did, came on down, and then were either wiped out by the Native Americans, or what I think is more likely is this was an older occupation. These people made it in here maybe 50, 60,000 years ago, and they didn't survive. They were probably small groups. Most of them died out. And then you had one or two remnant groups just holding on in parts of South America. And by the time the Beringians, now Native Americans, made their way down there, they met these groups, interbred briefly before either being wiped out completely or just dying out on their own, and that was it. This is the last, in my mind, this genetic signature are like the last thralls of this once amazingly great exploration team that made their way into the Americas and almost completely died out.
This was the only evidence of a civilization before the what we now think of as the natives of, but I mean,
only evidence of that we have of humans in the Americas at that time.
It is impressive to think you're the first people cutting brush through the South American rainforest, and you stumble upon this village that's been there for 1,000 years.
But it's also impressive to think, I wonder, you know, there are a bunch of Australasian peoples within the Americas at a certain time, and most of them died out. Was this a small little search party group that made their way onto these continents without realizing it, and just for whatever reason, you know, ended up as their only stronghold being in South America? Whatever it is, it completely changes our story of the world, of the Australasians, of the Native Americans, of everything going on in the Americas at that time. It's an amazing story. It's super interesting. And as we get better DNA and figure out the answer to this particular question and exactly what happened, I think it's one of the last great stories of the occupation of the Americas.
For fans who might have come to the show within the last month or two, we once did a story where a woman had sex with a dolphin for science.
Right.
There was LSD involved.
Actually, multiple researchers had sex with dolphins, if you remember.
If you remember,
she had sex with a dolphin, and then people were making a big deal about it, and another guy came out and was like, hey, what's everybody getting mad about? I was doing this in the 60s.
The episode was so good, and the story was so good, we did 3 episodes about it.
Right.
And we revisited it with the 4th episode later. Uh-huh. And what you're saying is that story that you've just told about Aboriginal Australians in South America, while interesting, you're saying more interesting than dolphin sex.
Way more interesting than dolphin sex, and it feels better.
You and I we're just 2 different species almost. We are the Tasmanian tiger, and I am a wolf in Bugs Bunny drag trying to seduce
stripes.
You.
Yeah, very, very interesting stuff. This genetic profile also did a bunch of stuff. It confirmed that the oldest known mummy in the entire world, the Spirit Cave mummy, was indeed a Native American. There was arguments about that before because it was so old. It was over 10,000 years old. So some people were saying, oh, maybe this was a different group. No, the genetics show it wasn't. It shows this amazing amount of spread throughout all these different groups of people. These genetic studies, which are, by the way, published a bunch of different combined studies, published in Cell, published in Nature, published in Science. This genetic profile, this genetic database is going to continue to change how we look at the DNA of peoples of the Americas, and it's going to continue to be the reference point that we check things against when we find any kind of genetic anomalies.
You said at the beginning of this article that there were a lot of people, and even in your field, who didn't know about this.
Right.
Do you know predominantly European, Australian archaeologists who just are not willing to give an aborigine a short no matter what?
Most of it's probably racism. No, it's just an underreported story, and you have to kind of know what's going on to understand why it's so important. But incredibly interesting stuff. This really is kind of ironing out this. I think by the time I die, we will know pretty much the whole story of the occupation of the Americas, which is pretty exciting. All right, let's move right on to the Miss Reports.
The Miss Reports, where we tell you how wrong you are.
All right, I had to cover this. My wife actually came to me with this story and was like, hey, my boss was talking about this like alien probe that's coming through. And I was like, no. And she's like, no. There's a bunch of Harvard scientists. They're having a press conference about an alien probe. And I was like,
no.
She's like, no, my boss is really into it. I was like, nah, okay, all right. So, indeed, you guys might have seen this.
Did you go into her boss's office and then get her fired?
Yeah.
Is that the next part of the story?
I threw a rock at him. I was like, how's that for a probe? This has to do with an interstellar object called Umaumau.
This already doesn't sound real.
It's a Hawaiian name. It means like scout or something like that. But we'll just call it an interstellar object from now on. Now, it is interesting. This is the first object that we have ever discovered that we know for sure came from outside of our own solar system. So this object did not originate or come from the solar system. It came from outside. And we can tell that based on its speed and trajectory and how fast it's going. And the particular object is oddly shaped. They call it a cigar shape. Now, this was already an interesting object based on its incredible speed, the fact that it was the first documented case of an interstellar object coming into our solar system. It had a weird tumble. It did some weird stuff when it came into our solar system. It accelerated in a weird way relative to the sun that couldn't quite be explained by what we currently knew.
Wouldn't make eye contact.
Right, yeah. It was super into trains.
It's an autistic item from out of our solar system.
And so what some people theorize is that maybe this is part of what's called a solar sail. Now, a solar sail would be how we would most likely travel through the galaxy if we were to do so. This is a theoretical idea. You basically put up a large sheet like a regular sail, and as the photons of light hit it from the sun, it literally exerts energy like a wind would, like the same way a wind would against a sail, and you can push something. If you really wanted to accelerate it, you could point a giant laser at the thing and accelerate it from a long distance away. So the idea is this type of solar sail technology would be how things moved through the galaxy from an advanced civilization. People looking at how this particular object moved and accelerated when it was around the sun said, oh my gosh, this is working like a solar sail would. This must be part of some kind of broken down probe or other kind of intergalactic transport system that's made its way through here.
Could they find the laser hitting it?
No.
Okay.
That would be a kind of telltale. And a group of Harvard scientists did present a talk about how theoretically this had certain things in common with what we would expect from a solar sail. So, of course, all the news agencies jumped on it and said, it's a probe. It's coming. Aliens are looking at us. Here's the problem. What they were saying was it meets these certain requirements. If you were to read between the lines, what they also said was it's the wrong color. It's the wrong shape. It actually looks a lot like an asteroid. It's just a weird shaped asteroid.
And the settlers it's towing have been long dead.
Right. They're all Australasians. It's got a wobble to it that we would not expect if this was type of probe or solar sail coming off. It was almost a theoretical construct. Hey, this kind of looks like what this other thing would look like, though we know it's not. And of course, the news media jumped on it to get the clickbait headlines and said, this must be some kind of probe or solar sail. It isn't. If you hear somebody arguing this is something, this is a bunch of Harvard scientists said we were visited by an alien probe. We weren't. It was an interesting object, but that is not what it was.
Yeah, first of all, the Harvard scientists themselves say they don't actually think it's a solar probe or a alien probe. It's
Notice just, how that's not the headline.
Yeah, of course. One very good reason why it's unlikely to be an alien probe, despite all the other ones, is that solar sails are great for in solar system travel, not so much between solar systems or just throughout the galaxy. We have currently plans to send solar sails to the nearest star system, Proxima Centauri. It's called Breakthrough Starshot. You guys have probably talked about it before. The reason that works is because they're super duper tiny and lightweight, and we hit them with a crazy high-powered laser array down on Earth so that in the span of a few seconds, they get up to like 20% the speed of light.
Right.
Because once you send them out, there's no good way for them to break once they reach the home system. Yeah. The deceleration from the star is not going to be enough because it's not a super-powered laser. And so it's That's not the kind of craft you would send if you were sending a probe, and it's not consistent with its trajectory either, and the tumble it was having. So there are a lot of reasons to think it's not an alien probe. Maybe it's a very clever reconnaissance probe, and they disguised it to look exactly like a piece of ejecta from a solar system.
Yeah, exactly. They looked at it with radio telescopes and stuff. There was no radio transmissions from it. There's really nothing to suggest it. It's the wrong color for a solar sail, by the way, because it doesn't have
a racing stripe.
Yeah, exactly. It can't go fast. Just everything about it is, that part is total BS. It is an interesting object on its own. Just an example of how big our solar system is. So this thing is going at a crazy speed. It's really fast. That's the reason we know it's an interstellar object. And it's fast enough to actually escape our sun's gravitational pull and get out of the solar system, which is untrue of anything else that we have going around, right? So this is an incredibly fast-moving object. It came by Saturn a couple months before. I think it took like a month to get from like Saturn to near Earth. It will leave our solar system. The fastest thing that is traveling in our solar system will leave our solar system in approximately 20,000 years. So think about that. Like a month or two from Saturn to Earth, 20,000 years till you're outside the solar system.
People have already crunched some numbers, and we could theoretically reach it with a probe if we got a good gravity assist from Jupiter or something. Mm-hmm. So we may have not seen the end of it.
Yeah, but it always boggles my mind when you think of the math of trying to put that together. Like you are trying to hit a mosquito with like the edge of a sewing pin from 2 miles away.
Yeah, math is crazy that we can do this.
Yeah.
And the fact, you know, they say they detected an anomalous acceleration, and that sounds like, oh, you know, it just turned some thrusters on.
Right.
It's minuscule compared to the speed at which it's moving, and this is not unheard of. There's something called the Pioneer anomaly, where we were sending the Pioneer spacecraft out into interstellar space, and just very, very slightly, it was starting to deviate from our expected acceleration. And people had, understandably, lots of crazy theories, sort of as in this case. And it turned out to just be some consequence of the geometry of the ship, and it was emitting radiation not uniformly. And so it was causing pushback that affected its acceleration. And so there are so many explanations it possibly could be.
Including just solar wind acting as we know it acts on an asteroid.
If we were to send a probe out to this, and obviously barring any venom-type symbiotes that would come back with us, what would we hope to discover from sending a probe out to this object?
Probably a Carnage symbiote.
Question answer.
Composition of it probably would be the biggest thing. I mean, we're trying to find or, you know, send probes to some of the asteroids in our system that are like the earliest formed objects so we can get a sense for the early composition of the Earth's solar system. And so to get an actual measurement of some alien solar system's rocky composition of an asteroid or comet or whatever it is would be a big deal.
Though, to be fair, we do kind of have an idea. It's not like we have no idea what it's made out of because we can measure its rotational velocity and infer the inertia, which means we can say, hey, there actually seems to be a lot of heavy metals in this particular asteroid.
Would we hope that there was some deposit of something that we don't have a lot here on Earth? Like, not helium, but maybe a heavy metal?
It's not a huge asteroid. This is only a few hundred meters long. So this is not big enough where you're going to bring this in and it's going to change the global economy.
And when I bring on a chunk of platinum 130 meters long, you'll all be laughing.
I think the estimates of its diameter and size and shape are all actually based on, it's so small and far away that I think all the images of it are really just a single pixel, and it just differs in intensity. And so from that, they were able to fit a model and get the light curve and say, oh, it's probably a this-shaped object tumbling in this way.
Yeah.
But we actually don't know a great deal about it.
Which is one of the reasons that the explanation of maybe it's a solar cell could actually be somewhat plausible, because a solar sail has to be like an inch wide in order for it to work. And so we are so far off in terms of our scale on this thing that it could be 100 meters long and an inch wide, but we wouldn't know because we don't have the resolution. Like you said, we're down to a single pixel resolution. Very, very interesting stuff. All right. Thank you, Dr. Troy, for rejoining us for Science Faction 274. And thank you, audience, for coming back where you learned about the origin of our solar system. An amazing new series of articles about the occupation of the Americas and how we weren't just visited by an alien probe. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 275.
It's sad. You know, it's criminal, really. This caravan of alien probes is entering our solar system, and I've deployed a wall in the National Guard to prevent these rapists and murderers from entering our country. Some of them might be asteroids, I guess.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.